This is Talkish. I am Hella Kesser-Jane. The Hella Kesser-Jane Show is always available online at HellaKesserJane.com. On episode 316, I talk with two truly interesting people. Up first, chief political anchor for Fox News Channel and the anchor and executive editor of Special Report with Brett Baer, Brett Baer, here to talk about his new book, 3 Days in Moscow. And in the second half of the show, I speak with one dynamic woman, Randi Zuckerberg. She's got an important new book to talk about, Pick 3. And as always, stick around for my commentary at the end of the show. We've got a lot to get to, so let's get to it. Brett Baer needs no introductions. He's the chief political anchor for Fox News Channel and the anchor and executive editor of Special Report with Brett Baer. He has previously served at Fox News as chief White House correspondent and as national security correspondent based at the Pentagon. He's reported from 74 countries and has reported from Iraq 12 times and Afghanistan 3 times. He's the author of the New York Times bestsellers 3 Days in January, Dwight Eisenhower's Final Mission, and a number one Wall Street Journal and Publishers Weekly bestseller, and Special Heart, A Journey of Faith, Hope, Courage, and Love. He received the National Press Foundation's 2017 Salt Teshoff Award for Excellence in Broadcast Journalism. But today, Brett joins me to talk about his new book, 3 Days in Moscow, Ronald Reagan and the Fall of the Soviet Empire, a book that could not be any more timely as tensions between the U.S. and Russia flare up. Insightful, Baer revisits the historical role Ronald Reagan contributed to ending the Cold War without the firing of a single shot. And maybe we'll talk about Donald Trump, too. Stick around. Let's talk. Hi, Brett. How are you?
Hi. How are you?
I'm terrific. We got a lot of Bretts in my family. Nice to meet another one. We spell it with two T's, though.
Oh, good. Yeah. One T or two?
Two. We're a two-T family.
Okay.
Three days.
I'm a one T.
You're a one T, I know. Absolutely. Yes, and let's talk about this terrific book, 3 Days in Moscow, Ronald Reagan and the Fall of the Soviet Empire. I wanted to say Roman Empire. Where am I coming? Too much coffee this morning. Let's talk about this. You did a lot of research on it. It all boils down to what you call is one speech, right? Talk to me about that speech that took place in 1988.
Sure. This is coming up on 30 years. May 31st, 1988, Reagan delivers a speech to Moscow State University students in the heart of communism about not our system is better than your system, but sort of a Pied Piper speech, that freedom of speech and religion and movement, the echoes of democracy are the way to go for the future. And he explains that using Russian philosophers and poets and musicians trying to identify with those students. And essentially that speech, if you Google it and you watch it on YouTube, it's as relevant today as it was back then, and it may give you goosebumps. It does to me. I'm a history nerd, but it really is striking that this president, at the culmination of a long life of fighting communism, delivers this speech at this moment in the fourth summit between himself and Mikhail Gorbachev. And I use those 3 days to kind of bounce back and look how Reagan gets to that point, which is just a few months before the wall falls and communism really breaks apart.
Talk to me about this, Brett. The timing, diplomacy, president's personalities, Reagan, Gorbachev, the ending of this Cold War, so to speak. Talk to me about this timing. I mean, it took more than Reagan, didn't it? Also, it took Gorbachev. I mean, all the pieces sort of came together. Where are you on that?
They did. Yeah, of course. The book gets into that. And, you know, Reagan did not want to meet with the previous Soviet leaders and drop off Chernenko, Brezhnev, because he believed that they were kind of Soviet apparatchiks. And the other thing he joked about was that they kept on dying. There was a new leader every other year, it seemed, in the early Reagan years. But Mikhail Gorbachev becomes the leader and the general secretary of the Soviet Union, and Reagan gets a call from Margaret Thatcher, the British prime minister, who says, you can deal with this guy. And that starts a letter-writing campaign in which they establish a rapport over the written word. Eventually, they meet in Geneva, and that starts the series of summits, Geneva, Reykjavik, Washington, and Moscow. I don't say in the book that Moscow is the reason the wall falls. It's a culmination of a lot of different people, Thatcher, Pope John Paul, presidents who laid the groundwork, but also Mikhail Gorbachev, who is the vehicle by which Reagan can negotiate and get to this place.
Love these two men. I think they're phenomenal rapport, needless to say. We can't undersell Reagan's personality. I think the only person in the world, by the way, who didn't get along with him or wasn't charmed by him was his daughter, Patty. I mean, everybody else just fell at his feet.
Yeah.
Right? So what insight did you gain into who he was? What was this gift that he had?
Well, he had a gift to, you know, disarm people with humor. He was, believe it or not, not a big extrovert. I mean, if he had to be by himself and, you know, on his ranch with just Nancy, he was very happy. In fact, his diplomacy internally with his family was not as good as his diplomacy externally with either Capitol Hill or foreign leaders. He was someone who was larger than life, but he could identify with folks when he was one-on-one. And that's what happened with Gorbachev. They had knockdown, drag-out fights over policy and specifics, but they established a rapport in which, you know, they told jokes to each other. They said we're human beings above everything else. And it was a unique relationship. And that is the essence of diplomacy, unique relationships. Advance the ball to some common good that both parties find.
I find this fascinating, too, that great line, peace through strength. If you watched him, and, you know, I was alive and remember him well, you know, soft-spoken, kind, gentle, you know, like an uncle. And yet, peace through strength. So was there this dichotomy in personality that behind closed doors he could be tough as nails when he needed to be?
Oh yeah, he could definitely be tough, and it was the strength part that was the important part of the equation. You know, Reagan throughout his life is talking about communism, that it's ethically bankrupt and morally bankrupt, and eventually he believed would be economically bankrupt. And it goes all the way back to his time as president of the Screen Actors Guild in Hollywood, when he is talking about communism and the infiltration of communism in Hollywood. He testifies about that on Capitol Hill. But throughout his career, even as governor, all of his races, the big speeches where he calls communism is going to end up on the ash heap of history. The Soviet Union is the evil empire. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. All of these things at the time were said to be really inflammatory and warmonger-like. But because he is that aggressive and sticking to principle, it enables him, when he finds the vehicle in Mikhail Gorbachev, to be able to sit down and negotiate.
The book's titled The Fall of the Soviet Empire. There might be some who take issue that that's just words, because here we are. Putin's still controlling an awful lot, right? Russia's alive and kicking. Thank you very much. What seemed an enormous achievement? Does it hold up in the scheme of history?
Yeah, so obviously that communism falls is significant, and the Soviet Union, in terminology, comes to an end, and it becomes Russia, the Federation of Russia. But now, with Vladimir Putin, you have a leader that is much more like the Soviet apparatchik leaders of Andropov and Chernenko and that style, who clearly believes in Soviet expansionism and his own strength. So you have almost a tilt back in time, that Russia and did not take the advice from Moscow State University. But at the moment, and stopping the Cold War, that if you remember back at the time, was really dangerous. I mean, the movie The Day After was on TV, where this small town explodes with the nuclear weapon that goes off. All of that was the realm in which we lived. And this was a major breakthrough at the time, and we'll see how it plays out after Mr. Putin.
Yeah, I think it's important to bring that up. Listen, you're a conservative. You're a journalist. you work for Fox News, which many are now.
I'm an independent journalist.
Yeah, okay. I'll buy that. But you work for Fox News, which many are now calling the Trump Propaganda Network. I got to ask you about this. Does it not make you uncomfortable as a journalist to present at a network that seems to want to be many things at the same time, a news network, Trump's mouthpiece? I mean, where are you on all of this? Are you worried?
Well, first of all,
let me say one thing. Are you worried about all this vitriol?
I've heard the criticism, and I think that the loudest critics of Fox are not people who have seen my show. And I tell people to watch my show, Special Report, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, three times, and then email me and post or tweet and tell me what you think and if it was fair. I don't have a horse in this race. I'm trying to cover it fairly. Does it disturb me that Fox is called state TV? Yes, because we have a lot of great journalists who are breaking stories on the news side of the house. Does the opinion side have a point of view that is opinionated and obviously pro-Trump? Yeah, they do. But does a newspaper have a news section and an opinion page? That's right. And I think that people who watch me can distinguish between the two products, and the loudest critics don't make that difference.
So talk to me about this. Trump and Reagan, one so eminently likable, and the other one very divisive. I'll assume you know which is which. What do you think Trump could learn from Reagan?
Well, a lot. Their styles and personalities are completely different. Reagan had a sign on his desk, his Oval Office desk, that said, you can succeed in anything if you don't care who gets the credit. President Trump obviously does not have that sign on his Oval Office desk. But in the way that they deal with things, it's very different. In the threats that they face and the big moments that they face, there are similarities. And some of the speeches, I think the Trump speechwriters hearken back to Reagan in Trump's speech in Warsaw, Poland, in his speech in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, in the United Nations, in his speech at the State of the Union. There are echoes of the same themes there. Now, how President Trump will deal with the summit with North Korea, how that all, you know, comes to pass, will he get up from the table if the deal's not right? Those are all things the Secretary of State Schultz told me he could learn from Reagan by seeing how he operated in these four summits.
Well, the one book Donald Trump ought to read, 3 Days in Moscow. Thanks, Brett.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Brett Baer. His book, 3 Days in Moscow, Ronald Reagan and the Fall of the Soviet Empire. For more information on Brett and his book, visit his website at brettbaer.com and follow Brett on Twitter at Brett Baer. You are listening to the Hallie Kesser-Jane Show. My guest today is Brett Baer, chief political anchor for Fox News Channel and the anchor and executive editor of Special Report with Brett Baer and the author of 3 Days in Moscow, Ronald Reagan and the Fall of the Soviet Empire, and Randy Zuckerberg, the author of Pick 3. The Hallie Kesser-Jane Show posts new podcasts Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern at HallieKesserJane.com and is available wherever you listen to your podcasts. Be sure to find me on Spotify and on your Alexa device. Are you like I am trying to figure out how to fit in everything that you have on your daily to-do list into your day and still get enough sleep to move on to tomorrow's challenges? Yes? Well, we are not alone. Imagine that Randy Zuckerberg, yes, sister of that other sort of well-known Zuckerberg, the New York Times best-selling author, the founder and CEO of Zuckerberg Media, and host of Dot Complicated on Sirius XM, suffers from the same challenges that we do. Okay, and a few more. It's a wonder that with her myriad commitments that Randy manages to tweet and Facebook, but Twitter is important to this part of her story. In the modern day of social media, after all, social media runs in her blood, her newest book, Pick 3, You Can Have It All, Just Not Every Day, began with a tweet. Yes, that's true. Randy Zuckerberg first introduced the concept of Pick 3 in a tweet called The Entrepreneur's Dilemma. 1. Work. 2. Sleep. 3. Fitness. 4. Family. 5. Friends. Now, Pick 3. It went viral. Randy expands on her philosophy and inspires others to follow her lead and learn how to reject the unrealistic burden of balance and enjoy success in their own lives by picking the most important areas to focus on in any given day. And what Randy builds as a motivational handbook, both a business how-to and a self-help guide, takes on the fallacy of the well-balanced life, arguing that the key to success is learning to be, gives us permission to be, well, lopsided. To hell with we can do it all. In an increasingly demanding world, we need to learn to balance it all. But Randy Zuckerberg doesn't believe in being well-balanced. Trying to do so only leaves us frustrated and feeling inadequate. Randy's solution? Again, just pick three. Only three? What? Let's talk with Randy Zuckerberg, the author of Pick Three. Hi, Randy. How are you today?
Good, thanks. Yeah. I spell Jane the same way you do.
You do? Is that a name?
I do, yes. I love it.
I get more problems with that name, though. Nobody can find me on the internet. They're always writing Allie Kester, Jane what? J-A-N-E. But there you go. So listen to me, lady. I got to tell you, thank you. I do. Here's why. I'm from that generation that says, we can do it all. We can have it all. I haven't slept a full 8 hours in I don't know how long. And, you know, it's true. As my fellow sisters in perfection admit, you know, we've been beating ourselves up on a daily basis for not meeting the expectations of my generation. Now along comes pick three. You have no idea. Listen to my word. Sigh. I sighed. Have you been suffering from the same self-imposed societal imposed pressure? I mean, talk to me.
Oh my gosh, you have no idea either. I start off the book by talking about all the guilt that I've been carrying around for so many years and all of the things that I've been apologizing for. And then I kind of think, you know, gosh, if I had just, you know, not spent all that time feeling guilty and apologizing and instead like turned that into productive time, you know, how much more would I be doing with my life now? And, I think you're right. So many of us, especially working moms, we just spend all this time thinking about what we're not doing, who we're letting down and feeling guilty. There's such a pressure of being busy and multitasking and being kind of a martyr who doesn't sleep and takes care of everyone else. And that's just, it's not sustainable. We're headed for burnout. We're headed for unhappiness. So it's time that we kind of get over this conversation about multitasking and work-life balance and just focus on the reality.
This is interesting to me. Was it an aha moment, besides the tweet? And you ought to, in the answer, talk about that tweet because it's hysterical. Got you going on this.
Yes, it was a big aha moment for me. I went through this period about 5 years ago where I kind of changed everything in my life all at once. I started my own company. I bought a house. I had a baby. Like, I just did all of these huge life changes within about a month of one another. And I just felt so overwhelmed. I felt like I was drowning under the pressure of everything. And so I put this tweet out there, I think more as a way to kind of get support from other people. I said, it's the entrepreneur's dilemma, work, sleep, family, friends, fitness, pick three. And I got so much support. You know, people were writing and saying, like, yes, I agree, but it's not just for entrepreneurs, Randy. This is for everyone. Everyone can only pick three of these categories, not just people starting a company. And so I've dedicated really the last 5 years to studying, researching, and writing about this and exploring how different people prioritize their time.
The five that you picked, talk about that first. Because I want to ask you something after you tell me what they are. Talk to me.
Sure. Okay. So, and I tried to make the categories as broad as possible so that they could accommodate the people of all ages, socioeconomic backgrounds, phases of their life. So we have work, which could be, you know, you could be a student, it could be in your career, sleep, which is pretty self-explanatory, except none of us get it, even though we know we should. Fitness, which is your mental, physical, spiritual fitness all in one. Friends, anything that brings fun and happiness into your life. So that could be a hobby. It could be your actual friends. And then family. That could be your own family, your own biological family. It could be the family you choose. It could be a church or a religious community. So any of the ways that you would define those in your own life.
So here's the thing. We've been asking the impossible of ourselves, agreed, right? Because you can't do it all.
No, and especially not in a 24-hour period.
For sure. So you're advocating be well lopsided. I like that. There's something about that phrase, well lopsided. Go with that for a minute.
Totally. Well, I think different phases of your life are really well designed to kind of go for it and focus on certain areas. I think, you know, if you look at most people in their 20s, that's a time, you know, you're early in your career. That is a time to put your head down and work and build up your credibility and your experience. You know, you start to look at people in their 30s and 40s, they're starting families, like they're super heads down. That's a time to really prioritize if you have young children at home. You know, so I think at different phases of your life, there are natural focus areas, and it's better to just go with that and give yourself permission to be well lopsided rather than feel like at every moment in your life you have to do everything.
So you mentioned guilt. I want to go back to guilt for a minute. I'm Jewish. It's in my bones.
That's right. It is real. The Jewish mom guilt is real.
I don't know how we all got that one, but we got it. But talk about this thing, guilt. Because guilt is somebody once said to me a long time ago, I didn't quite get it at the time. I kind of get it a little bit more. It's a man-made emotion. It's not a feeling,
yeah.
Right? So if you put it in that perspective.
That's right.
Go ahead. Take it. Yeah.
I was saying it's such an unproductive feeling, too, because I think sometimes even feelings of anger or envy or things like that drive you to be better. But guilt is one of those emotions that it only weighs you down. It doesn't, like, fuel a fire in you to be better. It only just, like, makes you feel bad about the things you're not doing. So for me, since I've started living by this philosophy of pick three and speaking to other people about it, it has cleared up so much guilt from my own life because I know that the three things I'm picking, I'm going to be doing them extremely well, giving them my undivided attention, doing them with real quality, and that the things that I didn't get to, you know, I'm going to find another time to get to them. I'm not going to put them off forever, and when I get to those, I'm going to do those with the same level of quality.
So what do you do? Wake up in the morning and say, okay, what are the three things I have to do today? Is that literally what you do?
That is literally what I do. Now, I live in the real world, and sometimes you plan to do three things, and then life happens to you that day. You know, you have these great plans, and then a child gets sick, or, you know, the smoke alarm goes off in the middle of the night, or something unexpected happens at work. And so sometimes, you know, even if you carefully plan everything out, you have to adjust your pick three on the fly and be flexible. I think we've all had situations in our lives where we've been lucky enough to pick our three, and we've all had situations where the three picks us. But I think no matter what we find ourselves in, we need to, you know, spend less time feeling guilty about the things we're not getting to and focus on how we can be our very best selves and show up for the things that we are doing.
So here's another one. You mentioned it briefly. I'm going to mention it big time because I think it's true. You talk about that brain killer, and I swear it is, multitasking. Oh boy, stop the boat. I want to jump off. Can you jump off? I do. I am so sick of this crazy. I mean, honest to God, just before I was talking to you, if you knew what I was doing, like 12 things all at the same time. I got a crazy day today, lots of interviews, you know, I got to get a book into my editor, yada, yada, yada. And I'm going, I can't stop. I don't even know how to stop. So now I have a new thing. Tell me if this works for you. I say, all right, I'm going to give myself 5 minutes on this. That's all it is. Just stay on the same thing for a lousy 5 minutes. See if you can complete the task. Then move on to the next. Talk to me about this.
Great. I think that's a great strategy. I'm with you. I'm over multitasking. I think it makes all of us we're unhappy, stressed out. The things that you're multitasking, you end up doing each of those things in a really average, mediocre way instead of doing anything really well. And I don't know about you, but when I think about the things that I'm most proud of in my life that I've done, those things did not happen when I was multitasking. Those things did not happen when I was, like, perfectly balanced. Those things happened when I just gave myself the permission to kind of go all in on one area for, you know, a certain period of time.
So, Randy, finding time for yourself. I'm going to say this.
Yeah.
How? When?
That,
are you kidding?
I know. That's the hard one, because I think especially for so many working women, it feels very indulgent to take time for yourself. It feels like that should be the last priority. But I think, you know, I know for myself and so many women I've spoken to, when you take that time to take care of yourself, you show up tenfold for the people and the things around you. You know, even just that commitment to get a full night's sleep, or that commitment to go get some fitness or meditation in, you end up showing up so much better for your work, for your family, for the activities that you're doing, that it pays off in spades. So I don't think self-care should be looked at as something that's an indulgence. I think it's a necessity.
You brought up meditation. Let's talk meditation, because I'm all in on meditation, and I meditate. And I'm guilty about taking the time to meditate. Oh, my God. Stop this train. I want to jump off. But meditation is really extraordinary, because it takes care of a lot of the issues that we're talking about here. I mean, one of them is it does slow your mind down enough so that you don't jump all over the place like a rabbit, you know, hop, hop, hop to the multitasking game and stuff like that. Has it worked for you?
Totally. You know, I think when I first started getting into it, I felt like I spent the majority of the time meditating, feeling guilty about all the other things I wasn't doing while I was spending time meditating. But I think once you get in the swing of it, it's a beautiful thing, because really even just 5 or 10 minutes is enough to reset, to take care of yourself. And there are not that many things in life that doing for 5 or 10 minutes can make such a big difference. So for me, I think it's a huge, a lot of the big CEOs that you talk to and tycoons in business swear by meditation or some kind of a meditation or gratitude practice. So I think it's wonderful.
I think the Muslims have something on us here where they're called to prayer how many times a day. Not a dumb thing, probably a smart thing. We all need to, like, stop, you know, take a second,
yeah,
regroup.
I think anything that requires you or that inspires you to be more mindful or have greater intention about how you spend your time is great. And I mean, that's really kind of where pick three comes from. It, you know, your five categories maybe are different than mine, but it's all about spending our time intentionally and planning ahead and having that meaning and that motivation. I think it really helps all of us.
You also talk about gratitude lists. I do want to just mention that Oprah is a big fan of that. I think we all should be a big fan of that. How does that work for you?
I think just, you know, even just taking one moment to feel grateful for what you have in your life is such a mindset shift. One thing we do every Friday night in our household, we always do Shabbat dinner. No matter where we are, that's a big priority. And we go around the table and we all have to say three things that we're really grateful for that happened in the week. And it's just, you know, this incredible moment. Even our three-year-old participates in this. And, you know, it really just, it shifts your entire viewpoint. It doesn't matter what happened in that day. As soon as you shift your mindset to what you're grateful for, you feel happier. Your body perks up. It's really incredible.
I want to just mention this. This isn't just for women. Men too.
No.
Right?
Definitely not. Everyone feels overwhelmed. Everyone's balancing. I actually interviewed quite a few men in the book also. And I think, you know, everyone, no matter your gender, your age, where you are in your life, we're all balancing a lot of things. We all make sacrifices in order to prioritize other things. And it was really interesting for me to hear that from men's point of view also on what they feel they're giving up in order to choose certain areas.
I finish on this with you. Lovely talking to you, by the way. I come from a long line of overachievers. You come from a long line of overachievers. Is overachievement,
yeah.
Right? Is overachievement overrated?
You know, I think overachievement can actually be an incredible thing as long as you make sure that you're giving yourself the space to be excellent. I've actually found in my life that when I've set out to say, okay, here are my priorities right now, I'm giving myself the freedom to be great in these areas, even if it means temporarily sacrificing other areas of my life, you know, that's when I feel like I've really been able to achieve things that I'm proud of. It's when we try to be great in 5, 10 things at once that I think we fall risk to burnout. So that's why for me, I think pick three does allow you to achieve true greatness and success, but just in a very manageable way.
Randy, thank you.
Thank you so much.
I've been speaking with Randy Zuckerberg. Her latest book is Pick Three. You can have it all, just not every day. For more information about Randy and her work, visit her website at zuckerbergmedia.com and find Randy on Twitter at Randy with an I, Zuckerberg. And now, a few words from me. Here's a question from my liberal friends. Is Donald Trump as bad as you make him out to be? Or is Donald Trump the fall guy for the Democratic Party having lost election 2016? By the same token, I have to ask my conservative friends, is Donald Trump as wonderful as you make him out to be? In a world in which extremes seem to be the order of the day, where polarization is the norm and moderation is treated like some horrid tropical disease, have all of us lost our perspective on who this perplexing president of the United States is? Let's get a little perspective on Donald Trump. Donald Trump is to the Democratic Party what Hillary Clinton is to the Republican Party. Have you thought about that? Both are extremely polarizing figures, the boogeyman or boogeywoman that each side likes to hate. I talked about hate last week on the show with my guest Sally Cohn, who wrote a wonderful book, The Opposite of Hate, that should be required reading. But hate isn't what I want to talk about today, or the political polarization that plagues our nation. Today, I want to talk about the GRRRR factor. There's something going on in this country that is different from hate. Below the surface, itching at everyone's craw, appears to be acute anger. GRRRR is the order of the day. This is wrong, and that is wrong, and this isn't fair, and life stinks, and Trump is stupid, and Hillary's a crook, and GRRRR, GRRRR, GRRRR. All you have to do to see just how angry everyone is, Democrats and Republicans alike, is to read your personal Twitter or Facebook feeds. It's GRRRR, 100%, all day, all the time. And mean. Ugh. Boy, is it mean out there in the social media universe, and snarky, and sometimes so cruel it makes you wonder. But underneath it all is full-blown anger. The GRRRR factor. In the political world, Trump took advantage of blue-collar white man's anger that the gods have been unfair to them in every way, shape, and form. Trump even ginned up their anger, knowing he could count on their vote if he acknowledged and sympathized with all that ails them. But that's politics. And clearly, while important, I think a discussion long overdue is really why the heck Americans are such an angry, snarky lot. And of course, what can we do about it? The internet has made it easy for everyone to take out their grievances on virtual strangers with little or no consequence. But there's plenty of danger in that. First, if you can get your jollies off with no repercussions with virtual strangers, rather than healthily dealing with your own inner angst, why not? And truth be told, hauling off online can become addictive and, sadly, oddly fun. On the other hand, online, we fuel each other's anger, gin it up, and at the end of the day, it all becomes a vicious cycle that not only repeats itself, but escalates. While we are these days a country loaded down with problems, many of them the result of our very angry politicians irresponsibly acting out their GRRRR in Congress, yes, politicians are angry, and people too, we are still the richest nation in the world where opportunities abound for which we should all be thankful. On the other hand, we're not all that different from other hotbeds of anger. The world is an angry place. I'm thinking of all the people of the world who are dissatisfied with their lot and take to the streets to demand a better life from their leaders. Maybe we don't kill each other over our dissatisfaction physically, but we do try and murder each other online in our ongoing verbal assaults on each other. Nothing is perfect in anyone's world, and some have it tougher than others. In that context, we all have a right to be angry. But none of us has the right to take our anger out on anyone else, and our politicians, who are supposed to be our trusted leaders, certainly shouldn't willfully ever take advantage of societal frustrations. Politicians can go a long way in fixing what ails this nation by fixing what is wrong in our politics and in themselves. And we as individuals can do a lot to change the course of our angry nation, too. Starting with ourselves. When you get that urge to smack somebody down online or tweet that snark you know will get a rise, take a few minutes before you do. Breathe. Ask yourself why you're so angry. Or better yet, killed the opposition with kindness. Kindness. Huh. Now there's a word you hardly hear anymore. Grr. Thank you so much for tuning in to Talkish with Hallie Castor Jane, the Hallie Castor Jane Show, a production of Resec LLC. Be sure to tune in to Talkish Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern, when new podcasts are posted at HallieCastorJane.com and on all your favorite apps. We are open 24/7. So, until next time, when we meet again, this is Hallie Castor Jane.